And now an Adobe Radio Takeover with you, me, and everyone we know.
Hello, and welcome to the You, Me, and Everyone We Know Adobe Radio Takeover Hour. I am your host, Ben Leach, and today I believe I've decided to kind of take this next hour to treat things as a bit of an oral history and kind of go through the band's past and leading up to its present, how I got from, you know, playing some songs very nervously in a coffee shop when I was 18 to being here in my spare bedroom / makeshift office talking to myself about my life. So I guess all this started in 2000 and actually I'd say 2002. I'd say the first song that ever became a You, Me, and Everyone We Know song was written when I was 18. I had recently discovered alcohol, and I was going out and dancing a lot, and, you know, sort of first beginning to chase after girls and kind of all that life, you know, youth. And I had a dear friend named Ashley that we'd go out very often, and one day she suggested I go to this coffee house and play a couple of the songs I'd written. And I did that, and it was horrible. I hated it. I hated the experience. I was sweaty. But a couple years later, I would end up meeting, a guy named Ryan Sherrill and some other guys named Paul and Dan and Matt. And I was playing in this band called Underscore for a little while, playing guitar, and I brought these songs to the table, and just through a bunch of myriad of immature decisions and thinking, we ended up starting a band over again, and the guys decided that I would be the singer. At first I was very much against this. I'm not really your type A kind of guy. I'm kind of pacing around my house as we record this, you know, so it wasn't very easy necessarily for me to picture myself singing for a band. But at that point, you know, I'd already given up my apartment. I had moved down to D.C., you know, living near these guys, and, you know, I also didn't want to let my friends down. So I said, okay, we can do it, fine. And so we started on March 6th, 2006, and one of the first songs we wrote was, wrote together and kind of, like, all played as a band was called, ended up being called Because I Spit Hot Fire. That song is just kind of about that time frame, you know, just a night in my life. Looking at myself drinking and becoming less of a person than I generally hoped to be in life, I found that, drinking allowed me to turn off a lot of my anxieties and my concerns about myself and the world around me. I just kind of go along with whatever I saw everybody else doing in life. and in that, is it a bit of a bummer? but it's part of a very long journey. So this is the song, Because I Spit Hot Fire, off of the band's first release, Party for the Grown and Sexy.
Sweat soaks his shirt, and he's feeling his blood. He's taking his time as we're playing out the last note to your calling song.
Welcome back. You are listening to an oral history of my band, You, Me, and Everyone We Know, told by me, Ben Leach, on this hour of Radio Takeover on Adobe Radio, talking about the past and my journey and my band's journey leading up to now, about to release a new record called Dogged on March 17th with South by Sea Records. We'll play some of that later. But getting back to where we were, so it was spring of 2006, and we were all very young, very stupid people. And this little label out of Delaware, you know, very eager, this small label out of Delaware that we'd been talking to as our former band was very interested in these three songs that we had released, sent them. So we're, you know, discussing that and sort of, you know, when you're in a young band, you know, you're going to make a lot of mistakes and, go sort of just kind of not think long term. You know, it's very youthful to do. It's a lesson that I still struggle with thinking in a long term manner. But we're all here, you know, talking about, you know, how to make this work. Like, everybody wanted to do as much as fast as possible. And so, you know, Ryan, Paul, Dan, Noel, and myself, all, you know, we were like, okay, you know, yeah, we'll go and do this. We'll record a record here, whatever. And then this guy, Danny, called, called me and Ryan and everyone else. And he was like, don't do that. He was a guy that, that Ryan and them had known for a while, and he was very enthusiastic. He had some experience in the music industry. He was working for a few labels. He was like, there's something here, and I don't think you guys should necessarily sell sign on any dotted line so quickly. So We were like, Danny, we don't know what the hell we're doing. Do you want to manage the band? He agrees to that. And we spend the next couple months working on a few other songs and flash forward to touring and so on and so forth. And we end up actually, you know, we do a little bit of stuff and we start getting some attention. And that's when two people named Richard and Stephanie came into the picture. And they kind of, you know, they had also had a lot of experience in the music industry, but we'd also heard some not entirely positive things about them. I'm not using last names, and I'm also being vague here so that I don't get sued, you know, whatever. So Richard and Stephanie, you know, took us to dinner or brunch in New York. I think I had French toast with bananas because it's delicious. The rest of the band was all very, very starstruck. But ringing in my ears were the words of several of my acquaintances through the Maryland music scene that were, you know, just be very careful, you know, and kind of tread lightly and so on and so forth. But, you know, at the time, I was still very unaccepting that I was kind of the band's de facto leader. You know, so I relied on everybody else and kind of ran things as a democracy. And I was like, if this is what everybody wants to do, let's go ahead and do that. So we let Danny go and hired Richard and Stephanie as management, and off we went. And we worked on some more music, and we ended up re-releasing Party for the Grown and Sexy with this next song on it. The song is called Living the Dream. I had just turned, you know, 23, and as the song says, and I was kind of assessing where I was with my life. It's a thing that I do a lot throughout my life. I spend a lot of time in my head, and that's where both problems and solutions arise. It's just kind of a self, you know, it's a timestamp of where I am and what I was doing. You know, we had a little bit of label interest, and a couple people had talked to us or taken us to dinner. But at the end of the day, you know, looking back on it, we didn't know what we wanted or who we were as a band. And you know, this song kind of stems from a conversation Ryan relayed to me with, you know, some label folk, and they were just kind of like, how do you guys, like, plan to afford to live the way you're living, you know, or continue living the way you're living and do this? Because, you know, I was sleeping on people's couches when we weren't on tour, and, you know, we were a band of, you know, what they thought was great potential, but very little means. And, you know, how are you gonna, you know, how can you afford to be a band, essentially? And so that's kind of what the two things this song was about. So without further ado, this is Living the Dream, and we'll be back after that, I guess.
Just lay in it. dumb enough to dream so big. Yeah, we'll sail through the sleazy seas, past all the casting couches, rock ponies. No, I'm not done yet.
We're not done yet.
You can't afford to live like this. We can. You can't be dumb enough to dream so. Yes, we can. Yeah, we'll sail through the sleazy seas, past all the casting couches, rock ponies. No, I'm not done yet. Well, no, I'm only getting started.
So last we were talking, or I was talking to myself, as I pace between my bathroom and my spare bedroom slash makeshift office. The band had just re-released Party for the Grown and Sexy. We gave it away online as sort of just a strategy to gain some more attention. We thought it would serve a good purpose. You know, it ended up, I think, making, or, you know, it was downloaded roughly 23,000 times in a couple weeks. So it worked out, and we were getting some attention. We were doing a few tours. Life was going pretty well. You know, we had some issues with our original drummer, and we had to let him go. You know, it was an awkward situation, but in general in life, it always sucks to let people go. But we came across Aaron Stern. Aaron, he's a fantastic drummer. He was at Bamboozle, I think it was. And Ryan and I ran across him, and we said, hey, and he was looking for someone to play for or with, and we were also looking for someone to play for us or with us, and you know, all that kind of came together really nicely. And in July of 2008, maybe, we embarked on the Beast from the East tour with Just Surrender and Every Avenue and The Morning Of, and Aaron started playing drums for us on that tour. Soon after that, we went on a tour with Lydia and the Deer Hunter and I, Alaska. And it was great. You know, things were going well. The record had been well received. We had fired Richard and Stephanie just before Bamboozle, you know, and I think the reason for that just came out of, you know, realizing that, you know, our goals and their goals were not aligned. I would say if there's a piece of advice for hiring people outside of your band for, you know, management or whatnot, let's be very hesitant to do it. Make sure your ideals are lined up. And yeah, I'm not really in a place to give advice, as I've screwed up in as many ways as you can, but I've still managed to survive. So I guess the real advice is just stick with it and be patient. So we're on tour. It's August of 2008, and we are driving through Georgia, and our tire catches fire and pops, and we pull over on the side of the road. I look under the van and see that the van was on fire. The base, if you've ever looked under a pan on the stove and seen the way the flame looks, it looked just like that. So I get up, I walk very quickly over to the open van where everyone's kind of sitting down. You know, if you've ever been on tour on a road trip with car trouble, you know, it's just kind of like a resignation of like, well, a couple minutes of sitting there. I say to the guys, the van is on fire. And Rico, a gentleman that had come along a couple months back to play keys and eventually bass and then guitar, kind of tucked his head back under the covers and went back to sleep. You know, and I was like, I'm not kidding, the van's on fire. Noel, our the first guitarist for the band, relayed a funny story a few weeks later. He said, I walked to the van, you know, as we got out of the car, I opened my bag. I pulled out my pack of cigarettes. I pulled out one cigarette, put the box of cigarettes back in the bag, closed my bag, and walked away. And then watched everything we owned in that van burn to the ground 30 seconds later. It was a, you know, it was an interesting time for the band. We were stuck in the middle of Georgia without a, you know, I'm not sure I took anything. I remember losing everything I owned because I was traveling with my, you know, suitcase or backpack in the van with me because I didn't carry much. But I think we lost all of our money too. I feel like I remember there being a picture of Randy Jackson that survived, like an issue of Bass Player magazine that our bassist Mike had with him at the time, which I found strange. But you know, thanks to the kindness of Noel's family, we were able to get back on the road. So we finished out that tour, and we thought a lot about what we needed to do with ourselves. We were kind of, you know, we're at this glass ceiling. We had toured a lot for a long time and tried to figure out what we were doing. And, you know, we had just been touring on this one EP, Party for the Grown and Sexy, for nearly, you know, two years now. And it was becoming clear that we needed to write new music. We had actually been arguing about it at the time of the van, like the moment the tire popped and the van caught on fire. We were in basically a shouting match, so I kind of took it as a sign, and I started looking up, you know, trying to figure out people we could record with. Other people, you know, everyone else in the van was doing the same thing. And it was right about that time that in September, when Ryan and Mike left the band, you know, they left for a myriad of reasons. You know, I think in large part, the two of them weren't happy. You know, touring life can be rough. I never really got a straight answer out of Mike outside of he was going back to college, but we didn't get to it too far into it. Other than that, Ryan would eventually rejoin the band for a short time, and we can talk about that later. But you know, so. You know, I was still amped on things. I was very determined. Plus, I didn't have anything else going on in my life. So I was very determined to make this work. So Noel, Aaron, Rico, and myself all drove to Minneapolis to start the recording process for So Young, So Insane. We took six songs that we had been demoing throughout the course of the summer and fall to Jordan Schmidt and a fine gentleman named Josh Kane in Minneapolis, and we recorded them. We stayed with a group of guys in a band called Take Cover in Minneapolis, and we basically showed up with, you know, no money for the actual recording, and, you know, I think we had like $150 to survive on, which mostly went to cheese, bread, and alcohol during that time. You know, amazing nights the ones I remember as far as, you know, an eventful young life. You know, it ended up being that I had to get creative with our finances, and start figuring out a way to pay for recording. So at the time, Glamour Kills had held a contest for like an unsigned band. They were gonna design a shirt for free, and then this other company was going to print them. So we ended up winning that, given that we were still an unsigned band and still trying to do our thing. So I used those to I sold those as like a limited edition print to raise funds to pay for the EP, and I was almost there. I was almost there, and we were almost done. And Jordan and Josh were like, "Hey, you know, let's settle up the check." And so I got creative. I thought, you know, creative once again, the thing that has to happen more often than not. And I went on Craigslist, and I was looking for jobs, like something I could do in the next few days in Minnesota that would make me $300. So I came across a moving job. Some family needed some rugs and some furniture moved from Minneapolis to a place in Virginia that was not too far from where Noel lived at the time. So I took that job, and that $300 paid for the rest of the record, and it paid for the gas money for us to get back to the East Coast. You know, band existence or any existence where you're pursuing something where the odds aren't great and money is tight requires creative thinking. It's a very necessary, it's a very necessary thing. On that note, I'm going to play a song off of that release, and we'll talk more about it in a bit. This song is called "I Can Get Back Up," and it is about that very notion of kind of reflect, getting back up and figuring out how to, in general, how to move forward. It's Bridge is featuring a guest vocal by Max Bemis. He came along and discovered the band at a time where we were getting a lot of flack for sounding like Say Anything, and he kind of put an end to that with this guest appearance. So here's the song, and we'll be back to kind of ramble more about the band's history after this.
So young and innocent.
Hey, so welcome back. This is the radio takeover for You, Me, and Everyone We Know on Adobe Radio. Today or tonight, this morning, this evening, this afternoon, today, we are talking about the band's history leading from, you know, when I was 18 and first started writing these songs up until now. And talking about the new release, Dogged, which is a 6-track EP, which will be out on March 17th on South by Sea Records. I'm very excited about it. We'll talk about that in just a little bit of time. But for now, let's travel back to 2008. We had just recorded So Young, So Insane. We were on a tour, a full U.S. tour with I Set My Friends on Fire. I know. You may remember them from Really Heavy Shit and a Soulja Boy cover. Great dudes, really wanted us on the tour, and we were, just stoked to have a full U.S. under our belts again in 2008. So we embark on the tour. It's going pretty well. It's interesting how many of their fans were very receptive to us. We were definitely a more pop-driven band compared to what they were presenting. And that's kind of one of the things I prided the band's ability to do, is just kind of, we will play in front of anybody, we'll win some people over, it's important to, assess that ahead of time, but, you make the best of a situation that you're not sure of, and you go out there and you do your thing, and you generally win over more people than you expect to. So we're on that tour in Southern California, and the storm of 2008 on the West Coast kind of hit and blanketed the Northwest in snow, which left us having to drive from California to Chicago for a holiday show at Mojo's. One of my favorite venues when I was, when it existed as it did in Tinley Park and Orland Park in Illinois. That's where we played, where things first started making sense. That was kind of the first show where I thought, hey, this could work. The music I'm writing with these guys isn't, it makes sense to somebody. But so we managed to get all the way home, and we are very unfortunately broke when we do. So I spend Christmas and all of my Christmas money in Noel's basement, hand printing all of the packaging for our first pressing of So Young, So Insane, and sent them off to Smart Punk to ship out to the people that had pre-ordered it. And away we went. 2009 started, and we started doing some touring. It was in January of 2009 that Ryan would actually return to the band for a few months. To see how things are going. When Ryan came back, it was interesting that he came back with this very intentional, why do you want to be doing this? Trying to drudge up a greater purpose to it than just, playing shows and, the reason for the sacrifice and the willingness to live in squalor. And I think at the end of the day, when he left again in May following a few tours on the So Young, So Insane EP, it was really basically my fault, failing to be a leader, failing to lead the band and address internal issues with members. I'd never really been a born leader growing up, and it was tough for me to realize that I was losing both Ryan and Aaron, two very, very talented and driven bandmates, to the fact that I couldn't bring myself to have necessary but difficult conversations with the rest of the band. And that was hard for me. It was a difficult time. I flew to Columbus, Ohio for a few days because I needed to get my head out of my ass and figure out what I was going to do now. And it was in Columbus that I found out that the rest of the band was going to be quitting. But we had, we had so much going for us at that moment. We had a tour with Forgive Jordan and Ann Arbor lined up, and we had 2 weeks of Warped Tour set up. So I did my best to press on. I found two guys in Baltimore, Augie and a gentleman named Matt, who just played for one tour. On drums, and we did the Forgive Jordan tour. I just kind of, asked the guys that were, Rico and Noel, the guys that were leaving, just to bear with me, as for this, just stick this out so that, I could keep the band going without hindering too much. And they did. We got through all those dates. It was a cool enough time. I really enjoyed the experience. The Forgive Jordan tour taught me a lot about life. I kind of started. I had a lot of difficulties on that tour with my drinking started to get bad, and I found myself being very openly frustrated with Noel and Rico throughout the tour, just because Ryan and Aaron had just left, and that was a very big big point of frustration for me. But fast forward to the end of everybody's time in the band, and I find myself in Portland, Oregon, thinking I'm going to start a new life and start the band from there, and so on and so forth. And I have a conversation with Trevor, the gentleman that recorded my new EP, along with what would become the full length, Some Things Don't Wash Out. Just kind of like, I have these songs, I'm not done writing yet, so let's just record these and see where we go, see what we have from here. So we went about recording this next song, what would become the title track to the full length, Some Things Don't Wash Out. Give it a listen. This is a nice refresher for everybody, I hope, and hopefully some people that haven't listened to the band before tonight are enjoy what they hear. This is Some Things Don't Wash Out, and you're listening to Adobe Radio. So we recorded the record. We managed to sort of come up with the financing a little bit for it. You know, we worked out a deal with Trevor to kind of take care of the recording, and we get it done. It feels really good listening to that song to know that, you know, I managed to keep things afloat, to survive, to live to fight another day, so to speak. But it's about this time, and it's about this time that Doghouse comes around. I had been working with a second Danny as a manager, a very good guy at the time, and he, in working with him, was kind of what sealed the deal for Doghouse Records as a label working with us. You know, it we had spoken a few times in the past, and the things just were never right. You know, we were a very young band. You didn't know what we want. I was a very awkward guy. We were very disorganized. You know, it's we weren't doing much right other than what we were writing and releasing. And, you know, I guess we were starting to become a good live band as well. But there wasn't a whole lot. We're just feeling around in the dark, you know. And so Doghouse comes around, and, you know, the record, the announcement occurs, and we get a few tours in 2010. And Rico finds some guys that he knows from the Tinley Park, you know, that area of Illinois, where he lived to play. He's known these guys for a while, good human beings. but it was right around this time that I also started kind of pulling back. I don't know exactly why, what happened. I just started feeling really isolated and alone in the band, like I was more of a boss than a member of the band, and my drinking started to tick up. And all that leads, you know, to 2011. We're on the heels of a, in the middle of an amazing tour, Glamour Kills tour with the Ready Set, and We Are the In Crowd. The record is very well received. It appears, you know, through press and online media that the band is about to take off, and I step into the van in Utah, and everyone has a very stern look on their face as they pass around a bottle of whiskey. And they asked me about the band's finances and what's been going on in the bank account. And essentially, I'd been drinking a good bit of it away and using the band's money to hide my drinking. and that was very tough for me to admit, so I lied to them initially, just flat out denied it. And then when I came around, I think... I came around to admitting that I'd used the money. I think I was still trying to figure out what the entire situation was, and I may have worded things. I may not have properly communicated my thoughts, and that's a regret of mine. I probably could have avoided a lot of trouble had I taken more time to figure out what I wanted to say rather than just what I needed to own up to, rather than just kind of rushing to them and being like, yes, I use it for this. And, you know, so I was still learning in my life to own up to my own shortcomings and really communicating with, men in a healthy, constructive way. and so, you know, a lot of my life experiences and things led me to make a lot of mistakes. It's not excuses, it's just the reason. And everyone left the band in 2011. In March, everyone actually left in April. I quit drinking on March 26th, 2011. After a not particularly crazy night in Los Angeles. We played the Roxy, and I remember, you know, I'd been sober for a few days just because at this point I'd been trying to quit drinking for a few, like a year or so now, a year or two. And someone came up to me and I was kind of fidgety and nervous and pacing around, and they were, you know, they asked what's wrong, and I explained, you know, I haven't had a drink in a couple of days, the show's supposed to be a really big deal, so on and so forth. And they're like, well, you know, one drink's not going to hurt you. And then one drink turned into a lot, and I just kind of woke up the next day after, you know, not an unusual night, and kind of had this inkling in my head that I needed to make a change. And it wasn't until a few days later in Denver, as I denied abusing the band's funds, you know, money that should have been going to pay down the band's debt, that I realized that what I was doing was addict behavior. And not only did I need to take a break, but I could never drink again. And I'm very thankful for that moment in clarity, moment of clarity, as I drove around Denver looking for a parking spot. I think that this, everything that happened from that moment was necessary for me to grow as I needed to as a person. You know, you have to, like, pain is a part of growth, unfortunately, and you have to endure that to really make sure those lessons sink in. And unfortunately for them, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, Top Shelf Records had agreed to release an EP for us that spring. So just after everyone had left, we released an EP called Things Are Really Weird Right Now on Top Shelf Records. Great label, great guys. They're doing fantastic things now. It's not a name anybody is unfamiliar with at this point. Which, you know, really goes to show their hard work and dedication to the bands and the music they release. you know, I had written this record, like, sort of resigned from the band. You know, I wrote the music for one of the songs, which we're about to play, called Sad Bastard Music. It was just a very weird time for me and for the band. I felt very alone in what I was doing, you know, kind of reflecting on how the hell did I end up here? Through decisions of my own and what, you know, what's still motivating me to continue doing this in the way we are. So this is the song Sad Bastard Music. And after that, we'll be back to talk about happier, more sober times in my life.
This sweater doesn't quite smell nice the way it used to. My teeth aren't nearly as white, my blue eyes half as bright. My taste for liquor ain't the same, I say that's a good thing. Beneath this crooked little grin, the ice is getting thin. But our times were never really thick. Simple arithmetic, it's not a mental trick I plan to learn. Too good at giving up, why bother covering a candle due to snuff? Simple arithmetic, it's not a mental trick I plan to learn. I've learned to live without, I'm barely flickering, just put me out.
Hey, so it's April of 2011, and you're listening to the sort of very unrehearsed, rambling oral history of my band, You, Me, and Everyone We Know. I'm the band, Ben Leepsch, and you're listening to Adobe Radio. Thanks for sticking in, sticking around with me. So it's April of 2011. My band has quit. I am, you know, a month sober. I do what anybody will do, or generally has to do, when everything, when you've destroyed mostly everything you had going for you. I moved back to where I grew up, Baltimore, Maryland, and I moved in with my mom. And it was a very interesting time. I was home for a few months, you know, getting my shit together. Sort of, you know, I got a job at a hotel, you know, doing dishes at their breakfast buffet, and then eventually I was promoted to the front desk. I was living a very sober, very, you know, regular existence, and there was a part of me that was like, this will be, you know, maybe this will be cool, and but very quickly the urge to write rose again. You know, it's I've come to learn that whether I like it or not, I'm stuck writing music. It's something that I apparently have need to do. So I call Trevor Simpson, the guy that recorded our first release, Party for the Grown and Sexy, and the full length, Some Things Don't Wash Out. And I say to him, I'm like, Trevor, I got these songs. I was like, I think, you know, and at the time, Trevor had also, we had a few conversations about how long, you know, I've been at this, and it would be a shame to quit now, and it would be a real bummer to just give up, you know, to end the story of the band and my journey on such a negative note. So I wrote, you know, I had a few songs, and we went to his place in Finksburg, Maryland, went down into his basement where we had a few times before, and recorded a group of songs that would eventually become a great big hole. That record, you know, was just a reflection on the events that occurred when, you know, the fallout of the band, you know, my drinking and mental illness, you know, essentially unraveling everything that myself and so many others had worked for, and sort of an update to, you know, it's sort of a, this is what happened, this is where I am, and this is what I want to do moving forward. It's a three-track EP that every, each song is just kind of that, you know. So we recorded it, and just as soon as it was done being mixed, we, you know, gave like a one-week warning that we were going to release it. The songs themselves were very interesting in that I was very uncertain about, I was very shaky as far as like writing by myself again. I had at the time delusions of like, oh, I'm gonna play guitar on stage now. I'm just gonna keep doing that. So that's why in those songs you hear, it feels a lot more rudimentary to me, and because it matched my playing ability after just not playing guitar very much, aside from like writing for the last, you know, 5 years. So this is the song A Great Big Hole off of the release A Great Big Hole.
It's a cold I always have, and God, could I use it? will not in every case lead to glory. Stubborn as a mule in quicksand, you drown with every two steps forward, cause two steps down. This was bound to unravel, that threat just needed a tug, cause only so much mess can be swept under a rug. Between my was's and ams, I think I'd still choose the latter. But seriously, speaking of which, just what the hell did I do with that ladder? I'm a patcher on the ground, not sure. Grown fit, I've figured out how to live like this. And the 15 elephants sitting on my chest don't feel like much when I'm breathing my breath.
You're listening to this, you must be thrilled right now, I guess. You know, who knows? I'm Ben Leepsch. I am the band Yumi and Everyone We Know, and I'm here on Adobe Radio taking over for an hour to discuss kind of an oral history of the band. I wanted to make this interesting rather than just sort of talk about the new record, Dogged, which is a 6-track EP coming out on March 17th on South by Sea Records. Pre-orders launch today, January 6th. I'm very excited about it. we're going to get to that, which would be the present moment, in just a moment. But I just wanted to talk about the last year and a half leading up to this point. Year and a half, 2 years. After, during the course of writing and recording A Great Big Hole, I met my wife, my now wife, Christine. She's a lovely woman. And we moved to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where I tried to lie to myself and think I was just going to live a regular, regular dude life, a regular ass dude life, and just, kind of work. I got a job at Pita Pit. I was working at a hotel for a little while. I left that job at the hotel to do what would turn out to be an acoustic tour with Squid the Whale and The Orphan the Poet, fantastic people. It was really great on that tour to kind of be on stage by myself. Like, I had never really played completely sober before, and I think the best way to go about going back into that is to just be completely alone by yourself on stage with an acoustic guitar. So it was a very nerve-wracking experience, as you can imagine. But I eventually found a rhythm, and it became really cool. It was a great learning experience. I again found the urge to write. So it's, where are we? 2012 now, and I am I got a couple ideas in my head. And right about this time, my good friend Trevor Simpson, is about to move to California to start a new chapter of his musical career, working for a bunch of different people in an awesome recording space. And I say, hey, Trevor, let's give the home studio one last go around. And he's like, yeah, let's do it. So I ride my bike from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to Hunt Valley, Maryland. Now, Trevor doesn't live in Hunt Valley, Maryland, but I didn't realize that the trail I was riding was going to be so sandy, so I bit up a little more time and knee cartilage than I'd hoped to. So I again called my mom to come pick me up in Hunt Valley at the light rail station. So I took my bike and whatnot. It was a fun day. It was a fun bike ride. It was very tiring. But we went, and Trevor and I recorded a record that I would call I Wish More People Gave a Shit. You know, when you... I put the album title out there first, knowing that people were going to think that this was a sort of, like, the fucking scene is dead, jaded musician kind of, you know, that, you know, that EP of that a local band puts out just before they don't put out any more music. Like, I put the record title out there beforehand because I knew that's what people would think, and I thought that was entertaining. But I also, the reality was that I'd written about a lot of issues. It's a much more of a social commentary release than anything I'd written before. Like, stuff like that is sprinkled throughout throughout the band's discography, but this is like a much more heavier focus on things like, you know, the degradation of the land base and rape culture and you know, the idea that this version of civilization is a mistake. You know, progress is the idea of progress not always being a good thing. You know, I tend to be a very wordy person lyrically, and there are a lot of things that get tackled in there. Just before, you know, kind of getting to the present and talking about the new EP, I just want to play a song for you on that called I'd Contribute More Dead. The song's just about a feeling of being feeling worthless, you know, realizing that, you know, you're as much, you complain as much as you are a part of the problem, you know. I am not outside any of the issues I talk about on the record, for better or for worse. So this song is called I'd Contribute More Dead.
I was just 17 in a world getting mean, so my mind took a decade long walk. Since its return, I've grown more than concerned, and I think that it's time for a talk.
Outdated hardware while shopping for phones in an overcrowded everywhere. it's time for a talk.
So put the nails in my coffin. I'll be resting my head. An average male in America, I contribute more debt. And when you wail against my actions or lack thereof, I'm sure you'll find shame at last inside. We didn't even need to read between the lines.
Welcome back. The You, Me, and Everyone We Know, Adobe Radio Takeover Hour. I am your host, Ben Leach, and we have finally reached the present day, for the most part. So I have a new record coming out on March 17th. It's called Dogged, not Dogged. Dogged, meaning showing or having grim persistence. I think it's very fitting. It's a very fitting title. I like the word a lot. So I decided to go with it. This record came about in the summer of this year, or of last year, forgive me, it's the new year, of 2014. You know, I had kind of been working a job that I didn't like for a long time, and I had recently applied for a job as a pig farmer on a high-touch farm, a job I was under the impression I would very much like to have. Christine, my wife, and myself went to California for a vacation / for me to record a couple songs with Trevor. once again, go out to California. It's beautiful. You know, Sequoia National Park is gorgeous, and Disneyland, and Walt Disney, and so on and so forth. It was a great time. And then Christine leaves, and I find myself alone. Sort of stewing on a lot of the problems I've had over the years, and I was kind of in denial about this whole thing in general. The fact that, you know, my depression had been getting worse and worse and worse for the last couple of months. I'd been having anxiety attacks and I had been manipulating my work schedule so that I wouldn't be working as much, and it wasn't something I didn't fully realize until at this point when I was starting to write the lyrics for these songs. And it was very jarring to me, and the notion that I still had the same problems I started having after I got back from Hawaii when I was 10, it was... I started thinking about suicide in a way that I had never considered before. I'd always had that, like, little id urge, you know, when you're just waiting on a subway platform, and you just think, what if I just dove in front of the subway, you know, that kind of thing, or, you know, you get the urge to die, you know, open the van door and just roll out, you know, what would that feel like? But this, I started for the first time sort of going through the ways I wouldn't kill myself. And a lot of this record is about sort of thinking about reflecting on my life during a time of suicidal ideation. Fortunately, I recognized these symptoms before I got too deep into them, and I sought help from a mental health professional. And it ended up being that I was just kind of in the midst of realizing that I wasn't happy in my life, and what I should be doing. Through talking with the therapist at a certain point, she interrupted me and said, "You know, Ben, the only time that you look, your body and your mind seem to be congruent is when you're talking about playing music and writing and your band. And I just don't understand why you're not doing that. You need to figure out how to go about doing that. Forgive me." And so it's kind of at that moment when you know, when an outside perspective, someone that's not necessarily obligated to be loyal to you tells you that you're fucking up. You know, it's another breakthrough moment. It was a breakthrough moment for me. So I, you know, resigned from my position at work. I spoke with my wife about, you know, taking on the lion's share of our finances for a short time while I got things back in order. And I kind of threw myself entirely into writing and getting the word out that I'm, you know, back at this and finding the right people to play with. It had been a process that I've been trying to get going for the last several years, but, you know, we just setback after setback. But I just thought I need to throw myself entirely into this to get it going. And it was about that time that I sent the record to a few people who then got me in touch with the people at South by Sea. And, you know, it very quickly became the beginning of what I hope is going to be an amazing relationship over the next few years. This is one of the songs I recorded on that first trip to California. It is called Does It Amaze Thee? Again, it's just kind of it's very much about just reflection, reflecting on life in the midst of suicidal ideation, a bit of a mental breakdown. I hope you enjoy it. I put a lot of effort into it, and so did Trevor, my main man, Simpson. Enjoy it.
Still.
Welcome back to the, we're now in the present day of this sort of unrehearsed, rambling oral history of the band You, Me, and Everyone We Know. I'm your host, Benjamin Francis Liebschnickel, and we're here. We've signed an agreement with South by Sea Recordings, Dave Conway, Johnny Minardi, Brandon Metcalf, Andrew De Torres, Brandon Day. You know, so many wonderful people are involved with the label. I'm very excited. But we want to add some songs to the record. So, and I'm like, hey, you know, let's do this. And Trevor and I, we get together in California and record some more songs. We add what is going to be this next song called I'd Rather Be Sleeping to what becomes a six-track EP. This song is at this point I'm out of the thickest of the fog as far as you know, getting through this realization of what I should actually be doing with my time and energy and calories and time I have left on this earth. I mean, shit, Rick Scott just died at 49. You know, it's like, you know, it's just life is, you know, you can't be obsessed with death without also being obsessed with life, you know, that kind of whole cliche of things. But this song is sort of about therapy, the place, you know, there's a place you can go when you want to get when you want to get away from all of all the shit stuff in life. As you know, it's an unhealthy place to go to find us an escape, but you know, you can always go to sleep, you know, and it's just kind of that, again, just reflecting on big issues and reflecting on my life about the fact that I was sleeping a lot on medication, and you know, the pros and cons of figuring that out and existing, man. You know, it's a very long and likely, for a lot of people, unending journey of figuring out who you are, and what you stand for. Mine isn't finished. You know, I still deal daily with, you know, issues I have with with drinking or with depression or anxiety or, you know, the childhood trauma I experienced, you know, being kidnapped in Hawaii or growing up in a world where I didn't, you know, nobody treated each other very well. And I didn't have a single male friend that didn't victimize me in one way or another. You know, this isn't a pity party. It's just everybody's got scars, you know. Limbeck said it best, you know, we've all got scars. But, you know, I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to be present in my life. I'm entering a new part of existence where I'm feeling more fulfilled and determined, knowing that I have some steady footing. I love my wife and my dog and my life. I'm very excited to be playing these songs with the gentleman I am, Ben Roth, Corey Gable, Joe Fuchsia, and Blaine Herman, my bandmates from now until whenever they get sick of this existence. Hopefully it doesn't come soon. But this last song is called I'd Rather Be Sleeping. I hope you enjoy it. And when I come back, we'll wrap things up and I'll let you know where we can get the album and, you know, all that stuff. I'm not good at this. Listen to the song. Reach now. I want to thank you guys for listening to this for as long as you did. I know I rambled a lot. I tend to do it. I don't know how to stop talking sometimes. I appreciate you putting up with me pacing back and forth between my bathroom and my spare room in my underwear. It's interesting how you build a life. The record is called Dogged. It comes out on March 17th, 2015 with my good friends at South by Sea Records. You'll be able to get it in stores and online. The pre-order is launching today. You can go to ymaewk.com for more information. The band is on the Twitter and the Instagram and the internet. We're going to be on tour later this year, as a full-time band again. I'm very excited. As far as other things, we'll have some listening parties in a few cities around the country of the new EP, where you can pick up the new record on vinyl early. I've got a lot of really cool things in store this year. I am very, very, very determined in regards to this band and its continued existence. So thank you for being patient with me along my personal journey. I just hope those that have been around continue to stick around, and those who are just coming on board are ready to hang on, because it's going to be a big, fun, wild ride. Thank you guys for your time. I want to thank Adobe Radio. You guys have a good night, or good morning, or good afternoon, or whenever you're listening to this. The world is huge and small now. Good night, y'all. I'm Ben Leibsch. Band You Mean to Everyone We Know. Dog It Out, March 17th. Adobe Radio.
This has been an Adobe Radio Takeover with You, Me, and Everyone We Know.